we left off in our session this morning in Leviticus. We're almost at the end of Leviticus. Let me make that bigger so that can be seen. And at the end of Leviticus, the significance of Leviticus is about holiness, primarily God's holiness, and how, obviously, we are to emulate God's holiness in our own life. And that's not just a worship thing, as we emphasized during the context of our worship hour, but it's an everything we do in life thing that we are constantly to be involved in, demonstrating God's holiness. And so there is an emphasis on tabernacle, because that's the place where God is said to have dwelt. There's an emphasis on the priesthood, because they are the ones who offer sacrifices and service in the context of tabernacle worship. And so there's a huge element of the latter part of Exodus in the book of Leviticus that focuses on their role in the tabernacle. And so, again, God says, these things need to be done so that you're going to be distinct, so that you're going to be holy and be separate, so I'm going to be honored and glorified, and the nations are going to learn of me through you. And so the specifics that are spelled out here in the opening verses of chapter 22 is you're supposed to separate yourselves from the holy things of the children of Israel, that they do not profane my holy name. And we mentioned that in the context of our class, Nadab and Abihu offered profane fire. Wasn't profane in the sense that it said something bad. It was profane in the sense that it wasn't something that was dedicated solely and completely to God. And so all of these customs that are addressed that came from cultures and cultic traditions surrounding the nation of Israel were to be practiced in worship to the singular God. Now, you've heard the joke before, and I say it's a joke. It's a unique thing that we say. Just because the Baptists come in the doors doesn't mean we have to go out the windows. You might think, what's that about? Well, some things that people do, we don't do because they do it. We do it because it's allowable. But some of the things that the religions, and I wasn't picking on anybody religiously, I was just using that as an illustration. Some of the things that religious people did around them, they did in honor and devotion and adoration of false gods. And some of those things were just, they were just really out there from the standpoint of what they did. The offering of sacrifices of children, the cutting of themselves and so forth, that the priest of Baal did at Mount Carmel and so forth later in Scripture. There are some things that they did that were not just not what God wanted, they're just not what anybody should want. And so God was very particular about the system of worship he wanted the people to follow. And I use the word system. I don't mean anything cold, calculating, industrial, mechanical, whatever, that there's no heart in it. But there's a pattern. There's an organization. There's a directive that's behind it. And so God expects his people to follow his directive. So that's what's spelled out in chapter 21 and chapter 22. Chapter 23, we touched upon right at the end of our class, was the acceptance of the feasts. And the purpose of those feasts, the memorial purpose, they were called holy convocations, special times when Israel came together to celebrate and to worship and to glorify and to be engaged in some sense of memorial, depending on what the particular feast was. I'm not going to go into details of all of that, but again, one of those specifically focused on the harvest section, harvest aspect of the first fruits that they were supposed to give the best and the first to God. And then the Day of Atonement is mentioned again. So in chapter 24, this is pretty much a job description of what the priests were doing on a regular basis. And I'm not going to go through all of it, but they took care of the lamps that were to be lighted. They took care of the showbread, the bread that was in the tabernacle. They took care of the oil. They took care of all of these things that were just part of keeping up the house of God, physically speaking. And so that's part of what's described there. The latter part of the chapter talks about the name of God being blasphemed. It's one of the things that's brought out in the early parts of the Ten Commandments, is not to take God's name in vain. And that doesn't mean just using swear words, but it means using God's name in a way in which you're not addressing God, not speaking about God, not talking about a God in a way that honors and glorifies who he is. Don't make God's name common in the sense of being profane, in the sense of doing anything that's going to detract from his holiness. Chapter 25 is another Sabbath that's addressed. And again, the name, the term Sabbath does not mean Saturday. And that's the way we often look at it. Saturday is the end of the week, the seventh day. But Sabbath is referred to anything that's got something to do with seven. It could be 7 days. It could be 7 years, as we're about to see spelled out here. It could be another cycle of seven. So when you see, for example, in 1 Corinthians 16, verses 1 and 2, it talks about what they were supposed to do as the church gathered together. And it says on the first day of the week. And it literally says on the first day of every week. What it literally means is the first of every cycle of seven. Well, how many cycles of seven are there? Every time there's a week, there's a cycle of seven. And so on the first day of the week in Acts chapter 27, the early church got together. And that's in Acts 27, Acts 21, you see it again. Acts 28, you see it again. You see three times that there's a purposeful, intentional meeting on a cycle of seven. And it's always the first day of the week. Well, they did the same thing in the Old Testament. So there's a system of order, not just sevenness, but a system of order about what God wants to be respected as holy and separate and apart from Him. Well, now in this context, we see another concept of Sabbath. And it's not a Sabbath day, but it's a Sabbath year. So if Sabbath in the context of day meant you don't go out and harvest anything, don't do any work at that time, and there's servile labor that was forbidden on the Sabbath day. Well, what's the Sabbath year like? Well, here's the description in verse 2 and following. He says, when you come to the land which I give you, then the land shall keep a Sabbath to the Lord. Now notice, the land shall keep a Sabbath. It doesn't say the people keep a Sabbath. It says the land will keep a Sabbath. Well, how is the land going to do that? Who controls what the land does? The land doesn't do anything of its own accord. It just sits there. It soaks up the rain. It grows whatever that's planted on it. The land doesn't make what happens on the land happen by itself. So the land's not self-directed. So what does it mean? The land shall keep a Sabbath. It says 6 years you shall sow your field, and 6 years you shall prune your vineyard and gather its fruit. But in the seventh year, there shall be a Sabbath of solemn rest for the land. A Sabbath of rest to the Lord. Now notice that this is not just an agricultural principle, though it involves that, letting the land rest. You can wear a land out that it has no goodness in the soil, no nutrients, no wherewithal or life within itself to produce new life. And so that's an agricultural thing. But this is not just an agricultural thing. It's also to be done as a Sabbath to the Lord. You shall neither sow your field nor prune your vineyard, but grows of its own accord of your harvest you shall not reap, nor gather. So if anything grows residually from what's been planted before, you don't do anything with it. You just leave it there. You might think, well, that's ridiculous. It grows on its own. You know, I'm going to harvest that. But God says, don't do that. It is a year of rest for the land. And the Sabbath produce of the land shall be food for you and your servant, for your maidservant, and so forth. So the point is, there's a rest of the land. So there's a sense in which everything that God did is anticipation of a final rest, right? So the creation week ends with a rest. And the people of God leave the land of Egypt, going to the land of Canaan. And it's described as a place of rest. That didn't mean they did nothing. But compared to what they endured when they were in the land of Egypt as slaves, it's a land of rest. There's a whole lot of the difference between being enslaved as an individual and freed, and enslaved as a nation and freed. So very quickly, as you go to the book of Hebrews, and you look at the discussion that's presented here, it says there yet remains a rest for the people of God. And that's talking about the land of Canaan. And so it talks about what we have accomplished or have accomplished through us on God's behalf and to His glory as God's people, as members of His spiritual kingdom, Israel, worshiping in the spiritual tabernacle that was made without hands. It says there yet remains a rest for the people of God. So there's something about a finality to rest, that it's the capstone, it's the end of something. It's the end of a week, it's the end of a series of years, it's the end of a multiple series of seven in the year of Jubilee, and it's a picture of the land of Canaan, and it's also a picture of what's on the other side of life in eternity. What's that going to be like? Well, whatever it is, it's described as being rest in some way. Now, let me just mention very quickly rest. When it says that God rested on the Sabbath day, it doesn't mean like God was taking a break because He was tired. You know, when you rest, it doesn't mean you don't have the ability to do anything physically. There is a spiritual component to rest, not just a physical component to rest. That it's a sense of refreshing and renewal, and that's everything that polishing the pulpit, for example, wants it to be. It's a refreshing and a retreat and renewal and that kind of stuff. It's not like you're too tired to do anything. It's that your body needs a break, all right? Can you stay up 24 hours in a row? Yeah. Can you stay up 24 hours in a row more than one day in a row? Yeah. How? Somebody shaking their head here. If you've done that any time recently, you will know that. You know, the older you get, and if you're not old enough to have this sense, just let me say, it's coming. You will do anything and everything you do just to have a decent night's rest. All right? And so you start gearing your life. I remember talking to a preacher many, many years ago in upstate New York. And he said, when my mom told me this, I didn't believe it because I was in college at the time. She says, believe me, one day is coming when everything you will want is nothing. When the most important thing you want is just a decent night's rest. And he says, I thought she was nuts. I was a teenager and I thought that doesn't bother me. You get older and you appreciate a decent night's rest. Well, there's something that's spiritually involved in restoration, in restitution, in reformation that's involved in this concept of the land resting. And so it was done for the land, but it was done primarily for God. It was done for their faith. Because if you're not harvesting anything off this land for a year, how are you being sustained? There's the dependence and reliance upon God. The world didn't fall apart on the seventh day when God rested. It continued because of everything that God had done before, and that his sustaining providential hand was still in control. Same thing on the Sabbath day, same thing on the Sabbath year. Same thing when you turned everybody that owed you stuff and you forgave all the debts, you might think, I'm going to fall apart. No, you're going to continue to live. You may not have what you wanted to have, but God's still going to sustain you. So all of that's a dependence on God kind of thing. And so it's a system, again, of recognizing and respecting God's order. Now, drop down to verse 8. It says, you shall count 7 Sabbaths of years. So years every 7 years. Sabbath year, you got 7, that's 49. It says, you count for a year every 7 years for yourself, 7 times 7 years, and the time of the 7 Sabbaths of years shall be to you 49 years. Then you shall cause the trumpet of the Jubilee to sound on the 10th day of the 7th month, on the Day of Atonement. You shall make the trumpet to sound throughout all your land, and you shall consecrate the 50th year. So this is not just a Sabbath year. This is a Sabbath year immediately after a Sabbath year, the 50th year. You proclaim liberty throughout all the land to all its inhabitants. It shall be a jubilee. Incidentally, do you know where those words are inscribed on anything of great historical significance in our history? It's on a bell in the city of Philadelphia. And it's called the...
Liberty.
You guys studied history. I'm sorry, everybody's tired. That's not fair. It's the Liberty Bell. That passage that we just read is inscribed on the Liberty Bell about proclaiming liberty throughout the land. And so that message was used in the context of historically becoming a different nation, but also was used in the abolitionist movement later from the standpoint of freeing slaves. But the point is, you don't do anything for this next year, the year of Jubilee, in which all the debts are forgiven and whatever. You sell anything to your neighbor, buy anything from them according to the number of years from the Jubilee, all these debts are forgiven. So there are provisions that are going to be made for by God's people when these years come apart, come about. Verse 18, you shall observe my statutes and my judgments, perform them and dwell in the land. Then the land will yield its fruit and you will eat your fill and dwell there in safety. And you say, what shall we eat in the 7th year? What's the problem? We're not growing anything, Lord. What are we doing? He says, since we shall not sow nor gather in the produce, then I will command my blessing on you, watch this, in the 6th year, and it will bring forth produce enough for, do you see that? 3 years. So remember the manna process on the day before the Sabbath. What did the Lord say? You can gather double, and it'll last. So if you gather double and it lasts, doesn't spoil, it's going to get you through the next day. And then the following day, which is the first day of the week, the way we would look at things and the way they would look at things as well, it starts all over again. The food's provided for them miraculously. Only in this context, you're talking about a year. So the year before the Sabbath year, God says it's going to provide 3. So that's going to last for year number 6. It's going to last for year number 7, which you're not harvesting anything, and get you into the year after that, which is the 8th year. So it lasts 3 years. Why? Because the year after that, when you're sowing and reaping, it's going to take a while for the reaping to kick in. So you've got enough to last you until when it does. So the whole principle is God sustains you weekly. God sustains you annually. God sustains you on a cycle of 7 years. And you do the same thing on a cycle of 49 or 50. The point is God will provide for you. And so notice, what's going to happen? I'll take care of you. It's going to last 3 years. And you shall sow in the 8th year and eat old produce until the 9th year. Until its produce comes in, you shall eat of the old harvest. The point is, in the year before the Sabbath, you'll have enough to get you through that year, the year before the Sabbath, the Sabbath year, and well enough into the year after that, that the produce from that year after the Sabbath is going to kick in and you're going to have food. So who makes that happen? The land doesn't do it. So it's God that's doing it. And so God has said, I will sustain you. So you stop and think that there's nobody that does business like that today. All right, this is not a political thing. This is not a big religious thing. But I don't think Chick-fil-A is going out of business because they close on Sundays. I just don't. But the reason why they do that in this part, driven by this principle, do they have to do that? No. Would they be wrong to do other than that? No. But my point is, they're not. It's just a contemporary example, and they're not the only ones. There are a lot of places they don't do business over the weekends. They don't do business on the Lord's Day. That's a principle that's drawn in part from what you see in the context of Scripture. Now, going a little bit further, when you sell property, we're going to see this later when the children of Israel come into the land. They're not there yet. They're heading there. But land rights were very, very stringently protected. And so the land was divided according to inheritance by tribe, and it stayed within the land, so within the family. So there's protecting of land that's going to be taking place, so that if somebody buys somebody else's land that's part of the inheritance of a specific family's right, it's going to go back to them. So he can redeem what he was sold. So there's a provision for redemption of property if it's going to be sold. Now notice also that this is again God's order of things that's part of Sabbath concept. Sabbath isn't just Saturday. It's not just the seventh day. It's not just the seventh year. There are concepts for protecting people and protecting property and things. Watch down to verse 35. All right. And if one of your brethren becomes poor and falls into poverty among you, then you shall help him like a stranger or a sojourner, that he may live with you. Take no usury or interest from him, but fear your God, that your brother may live with you. So God's blessing people who have so that they can bless people who don't have. That's a God thing. And that's a God's people thing. So when you read the passage in Ephesians chapter 4, it says, let him that stole steal no more, but rather working with his hands, doesn't stop there, so he can take care of his own needs and assist with the needs of others. All right? This is just, you know, remember, God sticks his nose, so to speak, figuratively speaking, in everybody's business. Do you have more than you need? Well, most of us do. Maybe not all of us do. But if we have more than we need, what do we do with more than we need? Let me just mention, somebody walked up to me at PTP last year, still working with a radio program. He says, I've been looking for you. And he says, I got more money than I need. He says, here's what people who have more money than they need, here's what they do. They put it in the bank and have more money, or they buy stuff that they don't need, or they give it away. He says, I don't need any more money. And he said, I'm not going to give it to my kids because they don't need any money. And he wasn't being mean. Very generous man. He says, my kids don't need anything. And he says, I don't need another thing. He says, I'm giving my money away. He's not just doing it because he's affluent. He's doing it because that's where his heart is. And God says to Israel, if you have, help those who don't have. Now, let me simply say, and I want to be very careful not to get political here. Some people say, well, let them fend for themselves. In the context, it's talking about people who can't, or circumstances have befallen them that they're not able to do so. This is not talking about enabling freeloaders. Usually when we talk about that, we say, let those people get a job. Well, what if they can't? Have you known anybody who, through no fault of their own, was unable to sustain and take care of their own needs, let alone the needs of their family? That's what's being addressed here. Is talking about legitimate needs. So in the context of taking care of widows in the writings of Paul to Timothy, he talks about those who are widows indeed. That is, there's nothing else that they can depend upon except the church to help them. He says, if they have family, let the family help them. That's the first thing that you turn to. In this context, it's talking about, notice it says, you treat them. Notice the language here. He says, you treat them, you shall help them like a stranger or a sojourner. The point is, you're treating them, they may be members of your family, they may be members of your tribe, they may be people that you know, but you treat them like they're a stranger. What's the point? You do this to strangers too. So this is not just to do something to help somebody whom you know, close to you, has some acquaintance with, but even helping those that you don't know. Don't take usury or interest from them. Fear your God that your brother may rather be live with you. Don't lend him money for usury, nor lend him your food at a profit. Don't take advantage of people. Right? One of the things that's massive, let me simply say, this is the beginning of an endless stream of passages in the text that tell us don't take advantage of any other human being for any reason at all. Never take advantage of another. You know what that goes back to? It goes back to the Ten Commandments. Love God, love neighbor. How do you love neighbor? Don't kill them. Got it. Don't commit adultery. Got it. Don't take their stuff. Don't covet their stuff. Don't speak about them. Don't even think ill of them. This is practical. This is not just a stuff that you don't do. This is stuff that you do in order to take care of them. Well, I haven't harmed them, but have you helped them? There's a difference. Not hurting is fine, but doing more to help is better. So the context of the man that was beaten and left by the wayside in Luke's account, the parable of the Good Samaritan, the priest didn't hurt the man. He was already hurt. And the Levite didn't hurt the man. He was already hurt. So they didn't inflict anything on the man, but the problem was they didn't help somebody who needed stuff. And so we need to make sure that we're doing both of those, not hurting, but also helping. And so watch what he says. Do this because I am the Lord your God. Every time God says, I'm the Lord your God, he says that in an effort to get the people to say, I'm the Lord your God, you're my people, act like me. That's why God says it. God doesn't just say, I'm the Lord your God all the time to brag about who he is. He says it because he did something for you and expects you to do something for others. Watch. I'm the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt to give you the land of Canaan and to be your God. And so his point is, if somebody has need of help, remember, I helped you. You know, Egypt wasn't helping you. Egypt enslaved you. So I want to help you. And so as we go through the rest of the chapter, I'm not going to go through all of this in detail. A lot of this is talking about how to treat others that you are responsible for. And that's spelled out in great detail in that context. All right, chapter 26, very simple principle. God says, if you do what I want you to do, you'll be blessed. So you see lots of if-then passages here. If you walk in my statutes, verse 3, then I'm going to give you everything you need. So you'll see a lot of passages that will say, if you're going to be obedient to me, in effect, I will bless you. That's everywhere. But if you're disobedient, then you will not have those blessings. They will be withheld from you. And so that's the if all the good stuff, verse 3, but starting in verse 14. But if you don't obey, then this is what's going to happen. And so there are consequences to their actions. Good, God blesses. Not good, then God withholds blessings. And that's just a principle that's everywhere, not just in Leviticus, but throughout the text. So the rest of the chapter, let me just, if you're looking at it, if you walk, verse 3, if you don't obey, verse 14, if you don't obey, verse 18, if you don't do these things, reform by me, verse 23, if you do not obey me, verse 27, I'm just hitting the highlights here. The point is there's a constant diet presented in this chapter of the same thing said repeatedly. Do this and you'll live. Don't do this and it's not going to go well with you. And that's not a threat, it's just that's a principle by which God governs everything. All right, the last chapter is about rules of redeeming people and property that were dedicated to God. So if something was initially dedicated to God, persons, property, whatever, there's a way by which this is valued and redeemed and bought back. And all those details are spelled out. And there's a lot of detail that's significant. And I'm not going to go into it, but just hit the highlights that are presented here. And I want to sum this up and at least get into the start of the book of Numbers. I think in our reading today, we're supposed to finish near Numbers chapter 10. And so we're not going to get that far, but we'll get into it. So let's just use this as a guideline to review the book of Leviticus. And there's a lot. It's not as long as Genesis or Exodus, 50 chapters, 40 chapters. This is only 27. But the substance is totally different because of the emphasis on meticulous rules and the emphasis on extensive preparation offering sacrifices in the temple, in the tabernacle. It's just a lot to digest. So the book of Leviticus plays an important role in the unraveling of the plan of salvation. And I say unraveling, it's not that we need to unravel, God needs to unravel it, it's we need to grasp it. From this book, we learn such great and important things as the holiness of God. That's the central thing. Note the number of times the statement is made that God is holy, therefore the children of Israel to be holy. We cited two as our key in our lesson this morning, chapter 11, verse 44 and 45, but that's not the only text. There are many others explicitly say that and implicitly say that as well. So this is also shown through the fact that God brought them out of the land of Egypt. I'm the Lord your God. I did this for you. What are you going to do for others? In effect, this is what God's saying. So the value of the children of Israel to God, number two. Number three, the existence of sin in mankind. God's holy and we're not. Numerous commands in the book of Leviticus not only show us the greatness and holiness of God, but seen from God's perspective, it shows that we are weak and sinful. And that might make us uncomfortable, but that's constantly there. One of the things before we find out how much God loves us is to recognize how much in need of love we are. And that's showing man's folly, man's failure to be what God wants. And so there has to be an acceptance and an admittance of that. That, you know, that's the whole Isaiah thing in chapter 6. I realized I'm undone. Number 4, man could do something to stand right in the sight of the Lord based upon his obedience to God. It's not man's doing this on his own accord. He is not saving himself. He's doing what God's asking him to do. So all the statutes, the rules, and regulations bewilders people. So often we only see the fact that these only serve to point out sins. And they did. That's sin, that's sin, that's sin, that's sin. Everywhere you look, God's pointing out sin by means of the rules. But that's not the extent of it. Here's how you get away from that. Here's how you overcome that. Here's how sin doesn't entrap you and hold you as it has before. In addition to showing sins, the law has demonstrated there's something we could do about it. And God initiated those directives. It's not like I made this way up to get out of the sin, and here's what I want to do. No, God's the one who's told us how to do that. And so the laws are something that we could do. We follow God's commandments because we respect God's law in telling us about something. So this is a very uncomfortable thing in growing up in life. If your mom and dad loved you, they'd let you do anything you wanted, right? That's what we act like. If you love me, let me do this. You know, you see television shows, movies, whatever, and real life experience. If you love me, you let me do it, whatever it is. And I'm sorry, it sounds like it's a plaintive person saying that, but sometimes we do that. In effect, we did this in our first lesson. Adam and Eve never said these things to God because they couldn't have gotten away with it. They knew better. If you love this, you really wouldn't hold us responsible for X, whatever X was. Well, God holds us responsible for our shortcomings. So God tells us about them. If you are a pitiful student, I saw this heard this in an interview, and this professor was actually head of a college, and a student came to her and complained that she got a C on a paper. And teacher looked at it and she said it was a C paper. She goes, and she mentioned another instructor. She says, I always get A's from instructor so-and-so. And so this instructor went to talk to the other instructor, said, I gave a student a C, and this student tells me every time you grade their paper, she always gets an A. What's up with that? He says, I want to encourage her. He says, you're not helping somebody. You're not helping somebody by telling them they're better than they are. And I want to be careful. God is not trying to beat us up, but he's trying to paint a picture of where we really are. God didn't say, I like you, you're a nice guy, I know you've done lots wrong, but don't worry about it, I'm going to give you an A. If you are, and the whole grading system is not how God works, obviously, but God doesn't gloss over our shortcomings. It's one of the beauties of the Bible is that God paints a picture of who we really are. You know, if your mirror is a regular mirror, it's going to show you what you really look like. When I look into the mirror, I don't see Paul Newman. You know, and I don't. And I don't see Brad Pitt. I don't see any of those guys. I look in the mirror and I'm thinking, who in the wide world is that ugly guy? You know, my point is that shows me what I really am. And there's a picture in the book of James. When you look into God's word, it shows you what you really are. That mirror shows you what you really are. Leviticus is showing God's people what they really are. What do I look like? God says, look here, I'll show you what you look like. This is how I look at you. All right? He doesn't look at me from standpoint of height, weight, color, hair, eyes, and that kind of stuff. God's mirror reflects where I am spiritually speaking. So sin that's pointed out in the context of the book of Leviticus is to identify who we are and where we are in God's sight. And so God loves us, and he says, this is what I want you to do, loving me. So law shows our sin and shows that it was added because of sin. Galatians chapter 3 tells us that. And so the book of Leviticus is going to address that. Now, something else that's important, and I didn't say anything about it, but I was going to when we get in the book of Numbers and start. Leviticus doesn't move anywhere. There's no time, start, time, end. It's just commandments and all kinds of stuff that needs to be done. There's no history that's told. Israel's not going anywhere. They're not halfway to Canaan. They're not knocking on the door of Canaan. It's just stand still. A lot of rules and regulations. So nothing takes place. There's no movement there. But the significance of it is it's going to direct how they're supposed to behave when they do move. Just a reminder, Genesis, thousands of years of history. Exodus through Deuteronomy, 40 years, not counting the years of Moses' first 40 years in Egypt and then 40 years in the wilderness. The rest of it is Moses as the one who's going to lead them out to their departure when you get to the end of Deuteronomy. That's 40 years in four books. Leviticus doesn't move anywhere. Exodus, they move, but where do they move? They move from Egypt to Sinai. Not a whole lot of movement. And it's only after Exodus that they move. When we get to Numbers, that's where the people are moving. So Numbers, just think, they're not only counting days, but they're counting miles. So when you think Numbers, think counting days, counting people, counting miles. Numbers is where all the movement is. Deuteronomy, they're all encamped, ready to go into the land of Canaan at the end of 40 years. So the only text that chronicles a lot of movement and passage of time from Deuteronomy, from Exodus to Deuteronomy, is the book of Numbers. So Leviticus is a standing still, here's the regulations thing. Just to keep that in mind. So it's not a continuous geographical numeric, transition going from Exodus to the time of the book of Deuteronomy. Numbers is going to have most of the movement. So they're still there at Mount Sinai. First chapter of the book of Numbers, we're going to see they've been there almost a year, and Numbers is where they move. They're ready to head out at the end of Exodus, but Leviticus draws us back into all the rules that were given as part of the law, Exodus 20 and following, and now they're going to go forward. So notice verse 31 of chapter 26. God said he's not going to accept the sacrifices of the children of Israel if they're going to be disobedient. The obedience, the sacrifices are all going to count if you're living right the rest of the time. Repeat what we said in our worship hour. Worship counts for nothing if you don't live right when you're not in worship. You can't worship God right and live wrong the rest of the time. So you can't live wrong the rest of the time, come to worship on Sunday and say, I'm going to make all this right because I'm here in worship. That's just not the way that works. All right, greatest lesson learned from Leviticus, the fact the children of Israel were privileged by all the things that God asked them to do, keeping the memorials, the ceremonies, the sacrifices, to have God dwell in their midst. Holiness of God, holy Israel, because they followed God's directive so God could live in their midst, figuratively in the tabernacle. That, of course, applies to the church. The children of Israel had much to do in order for God to dwell in their tabernacle. Notice the number of times God says, don't profane my tabernacle. Remember, just not trying to be, to lessen the importance of it, God says, in effect, keep my house clean. Keep my house clean spiritually. And the tabernacle is to be kept clean. That's why he says, don't do anything to profane the tabernacle. If you live ungodly the rest of the time when you're not involved in assembling, then you're profaning the tabernacle. Well, we didn't do anything on Sunday. And that's not the point. You weren't living right. All right, so this is an addendum to the book of Leviticus. Took so much ceremony and legislation to make the children of Israel clean enough, keeping the house clean for the Lord, to dwell only figuratively in their midst, that is, in the tabernacle. Then think how clean, pure, holy, consecrated Christians must be so that God dwells within us today. It's a higher level of cleansing because it's accomplished because of the singular sacrifice of Christ. So the keeping the house clean principle is amplified many times over by means of the sacrifice of Jesus. When this is considered, it becomes that much more important that we realize how much the sacrifice of Jesus the Christ should mean. One sacrifice took the place of multiplied millions. One sacrifice offered one time outside the city of Jerusalem took the place of all the sacrifices offered over the course of 1,500 years. You can't measure that. It's immeasurable. Jews had to keep all those ordinances that we see found in the book of Leviticus, but we as Christians have the ultimate sacrifice. Jesus died once for all forever. That's Hebrews 10, Romans also 10. No need to have consistent repetition of sacrifice of bulls, goats, and so forth. All we need is the blood of Jesus. That one great sacrifice was incomparably greater than all the sacrifice of the Old Testament. It shows us just how great, holy, and pure God is. He's so holy that only the blood of Jesus can enable us to dwell in his presence, ultimately in eternity. This then is the ultimate lesson from the book of Leviticus. All right, I loaded it last week, and it's the end of the Numbers is starting the same thing. Let me just at least introduce Numbers, and then we will stop. We will catch up as we do this next time. A lot of the Numbers we'll be able to go through rather quickly because it's a listing of all the tribes and the numbers of all the tribes. And I'm not going to repeat Reuben, Simeon, Levi, Judah, Dan, Naphtali, Gad, Asher, go through them then, and then all their descendants had X number of people, X number of people. You can read that. And you're going to read that if you haven't done it already. And so as we go through it, we will be able to survey some of the chapters and numbers that are primarily census accounting things quickly so we can get to the movements and the serious shortcomings that we're going to read. All right, so, and I apologize for this because it's a copy of a copy, and I'm still searching, and we'll still search for my originals. The book of Numbers gets its name because they numbered the children of Israel. All right, the significant number, the biggest number that you see, is 603,550. That's the number of men who went to war. 20 years old and upward, usually the cutoff is about 50 or so, not counting those who were older, not counting the priests, not counting the women, not counting the children, not counting those who were infirm, and not counting the strangers who left with them. I'll talk about that later. So the point is, how many people were there in total? We don't know. But the numbering of the tribes and the numbering of that number that I just presented is only part of that. So that's part of it. The numbering name comes from the numbering of the children of Israel that's found in the first few chapters. The book of Numbers also provides us with a listing of the duties of those different tribes, branches of the family of Levi. So I think, yes, this is a very crude chart, but and so it's not drawn to scale, But this is the outer court. If I'm not mistaken, this is 100 cubits by 50 cubits. The opening here was 20 cubits. And this is going to be 10 by 10. It's going to be 30 here and 10. And the holy place is back into this. And you've got the air, the altar and the laver and so forth. But the significance of this is there was a methodology by which they all encamped. So all of the children of Israel encamped surrounding the tabernacle. So the tabernacle was the center of when they moved, and the tabernacle was the center of when they stopped. So everything was tabernacle-centric. So this is aiming east, this direction. And so Moses and Aaron and the sons of Aaron were outside the tabernacle. So this is how they're all going to camp. And so Gershon, Kohath, and Merari are the three sons of Levi. And so those are going to be close. So Moses and the sons of Aaron, that's the high priest. But notice, here's Gershon, Kohath, and Merari. Those who are part of the descendants of Levi are camped closest to the tabernacle. Because those are the auxiliary priests, or the Levites, that did a lot of the duty service-related things. But then the rest of the tribes are spelled out. 3, 3, 3, 3 on the outside perimeter. So those who camp closest to the tabernacle proper were all descendants of Levi. Aaron, descendant of Levi, and then Gershon, Kohath, Merari. These are the special ones that were the high priest. So there's a model that's here. And the job descriptions about what each one of these different parts of the descendants of Levi did as to what person took down what part of the tabernacle, who carried what, how they established everything, all that's also. So their itineraries is packed. So I've got a list in one of my apps that I have in Evernote, and it's a trip list.
Didn't the ark go before them?
Yes, that's going to travel as well. And so that all order, that's, we're going to see that in the next few chapters. We may not get to it before we close, but that's all going to be spelled out. So I've got a checklist. And so when I check my list, depending on how long I'm going to be gone, all right? You got to bring socks. Ever gone somewhere not wrong socks? You know how many belts I have? Because I bought belts and I went on a trip and didn't buy a belt. I didn't have a belt with me. So I got lots of extra belts because I end up at somebody's house and thought, I don't have a belt. You know, and that's kind of interesting. I went to speak in a gospel meeting once and stopped and spent the night at somebody's house en route to there. And I said, Evelyn, did you bring in all my suits? She goes, what? And so I went up, there's no suits. So I was traveling to Eastern Kentucky to preach in a meeting for 3 days, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. I had no suit with me. And we were, church mouse are always described as poor. So we went to Penny's and bought a $60 suit. Can I tell you what a $60 suit looked like years ago? It was a suit that had two
like
pairs
a $60
of pants.
Suit.
That's it. Had two pairs of pants. One of them was reversible, as I remember, and we were too cheap to buy it, so I was at a different, and a vest. That's it. Had a reversible vest. So I wore that everything which way I could. I wore the vest one way, the other way, and didn't have it. But I thought the ties were overpriced, so we went to a place that didn't have any. Didn't have a tie. A store in town. Evelyn found a tie hanging on a coat. A thrift shop. It was hanging on a wire, on a coat hanger. And it had been there so long that it was stained on the inside with rust. And it was ugly. And that's the only thing. My point was, how do we get off on this? George, it's your fault.
I can't help it, you just bored up.
I'm interested.
But the point was, there was a preparation. I'll think about how I got on this anyway. But there's an order here. This is going to be the order in which they're going to follow. So how I got off on that is immaterial. All right, let me finish where we were and get back to. When I listen to this later, I'm going to laugh at myself. All right, like you're laughing now. But anyway, this is going to be the order of the camping and how all these things are done, the legislation. In addition to this, the book marks the beginning of the travels of Israel from Sinai. So here's where movement actually starts. They're going to leave Sinai, head towards Canaan. The book includes the sins of the children of Israel with regard to their desire for food that God hadn't provided for them. Their desire, this is where we're going to see them. We wish we were back in Egypt because we had the leeks and the onions. We made reference to that in our sermon. Their murmurings against Moses and Aaron, and ultimately their murmurings against the Lord. The failure to follow the Lord's instructions about going to take the land of Canaan. They could have taken the land of Canaan within 2 months of leaving Sinai. Why they wandered for 40 years? Because they didn't do what God said. When God said to do it. When God said, I'm going to punish you, he said, oh, we'll do it now. Too late. You're going to be punished. More about that when we get there. And their failure to follow the Lord's instructions. The reason for their wanderings in the wilderness is also provided in the book of Numbers. So, when you get to the beginning of the book of Numbers, this is the beginning of movement in time and movement literally journeying towards the land of Canaan. None of that has happened yet other than leaving Egypt and getting to Sinai. So they're still at Sinai. Through the last part from 20 and following in Exodus, they're at Sinai. All of Leviticus, they're at Sinai. The beginning of Numbers, they're still at Sinai. In Deuteronomy, they're ready to go into the land of Canaan. So all the movement takes place in the book of Numbers. So that's spelled out, verse 1. The title of the book comes from the numbering of the nation, and that's mentioned in verse 2. Note the poll was only for 20 years old and upward, so there's a numbering reason why it's done this way. This was the age for men required to go to war. And so I mentioned the genealogical thing earlier today. When I started looking at genealogies through Ancestry.com, I can look at voting records. Well, what do voting records tell me? Tells me who in family genealogy may have voted, but it didn't tell me anything about younger people who were too young to vote or people who never registered to vote. And so the only way those records are any good is if they met the qualifications to be part of that census or record keeping. This is the means by which they were numbered. They had to be a specific age. And that number applies to this group of people, but all the other people, you don't know all the details about. So 20 years old and upward, the age for them to go to war. 5 through 15 tells us the process by which the men were going to be accounted. So there's a means of breakdown, how they're going to be, how the accounting takes place. And then the rest of the chapter is going through the actual number of this number of people from this tribe, this clan, this family, this so forth, and it's broken down. And then the totals are given from each tribe, and then the appointments of Levites. I want to come back and talk about that next time. The Levites weren't numbered because they didn't go to war, because their service was doing what I mentioned, showed before around the tabernacle and actually in the service when they were in camp. And then finally, the Levites were to camp about the tabernacle, that there be no wrath upon the congregation of the children of Israel. So back to what this was. This was not just an order of encampment. This was an order of holiness as well. How is it an order of holiness? Because those who were consecrated and separate in a special way to be God's people who cared for the tabernacle, they formed a buffer between God's tabernacle and the rest of the people. So there's an insulating factor, so to speak, and an isolating factor, so to speak, and that the rest of the nation was kept from the tabernacle because they had not gone through the qualification process that the priests did to be that close to God's place. So that's spelled out at the end of the chapter as well. All right, it's a quarter after. I don't want to go any longer than we have. We've gone into first chapter. Today, I think our reading is through chapter 10. So next week, we'll catch up and go through some of these materials a little bit more quickly.